This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Puritans saw children as sinful, even bestial, as adults in training. 100 years later, parents started to regard their offspring as innocent, malleable, fragile creatures who needed to be sheltered. In the 20th century, we invented adolescence, youth culture, and young consumers. But of course, the story of American childhood also varies by region, by race and ethnicity, and by class. One constant is each generation's fear that the next will be spoiled, promiscuous, and generally unfit. In fact, a new history of American childhood concludes that young people are much more adaptable, resilient, and capable than we believe, and they've needed to be to survive disease, deprivation, unstable families, and many long hours of hard work. Later in this program, an update on the situation in the Ukraine, where some government officials, including the outgoing president, say that a new presidential election may be the best way out of the current political crisis, and your letters. But first, the history of childhood in America. How did children shape our history and vice versa? And was there ever really a golden age of carefree childhood? If you have questions about how war, religion, or industrial revolution changed childhood, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from the studios of member station KUHF in Houston, Texas, is Stephen Mintz. He's the author of Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
I'm delighted to be here.
And let me ask you first about that opening image, the title of your book, Huck's Raft.
Well, for Americans, the dominant image of childhood is an odyssey of discovery, a period of risk, freedom, experimentation, and growth. That's our ideal of childhood, but one that we've had a great deal of trouble living up to.
Indeed, and that image, I guess, you say there's probably no single image of American childhood that will cover all situations, but maybe Huck's Raft is the one.
Well, I think it is our ideal. But let me just give you an example of Mark Twain himself. He was born 2 months prematurely. His parents didn't give him a name for months after he was born because they were convinced that he was going to die. As it was, he lost 3 of his siblings and his father by the age of 11. And by the time he was 18, he had worked in Washington, D.C., in St. Louis, in Philadelphia, New York, and Keokuk, Iowa. Quite a different childhood than we have today.
And quite a different childhood than we sentimentalize, perhaps by reading Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn of the growing up in the small town America where everything was, just dandy.
Well, I think it's very important that we correct our nostalgic and idealistic images of the past because it makes it much more difficult to deal with the problems of the present.
Let me begin. You go back to colonial times in America, and one of the fascinating things about your book is you're covering not just white kids like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, but you follow African-American and Native American children's history as well. And one of the arresting conclusions you come to near the beginning of the book was that in colonial times, you talk about children in New England being captured by Indians, taken away, and refusing to come home.
Well, one of the interesting discoveries that one finds is that children are active agents who are not merely passive creatures. In Puritan families, children were put to work at extremely young ages, 3, 4, 5. They were punished physically. They went through very prolonged church services. And children who were captured by the Indians found them extremely indulgent of young children and seemingly preferred their experience there.
So that even when they're after sometimes heroic trips, their parents would show up to try to ransom them, they would refuse to come home.
Correct. We have some astonishing prints from the early period of showing young children weeping as they're being taken away by their natural parents.
Now, you seek to debunk a series of myths that you say cloud public thinking about the history of American childhood. And one we've already talked about, that sort of myth of a carefree childhood. This has never happened, you say.
For all of us, I think, look at our own childhoods and think of them as wonderful and fulfilling, or at least most of us. And yet, I think that there's a great deal of denial involved in that. And anyway, for the majority of American children, it wasn't an idyllic experience. Labor was a crucial part of childhood in the past. Tough family times were also crucial. Let me just give you an example. In 1900, 15% of all children were dead by the age of one. Half of all children lost at least one parent by the age of 18. 2.5 million children, 10 to 16, work 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. Of all the children who started first grade, fewer than half finished sixth grade. In other words, you don't have to go very far back in the past to see a world that's not idyllic at all.
The other myth you look at is the myth of family stability.
As recently as 1900, over 15%, perhaps as many as 20% of American families were single-family parent homes. We have an illusion that our time is going to hell in a handbasket.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that that's a long-time experience in America.
Now, the other, a third myth you say is that childhood is the same for all children, that there's this somehow condition that we enter as children that overwhelms everything else.
Just yesterday, the New York Times Magazine had a long series of articles about childhood, and there wasn't a single child of color, even though today nearly 40% of all American children are children of color. There wasn't a single immigrant child, even though 20% of all American children today are the children of immigrants. That is, they are either immigrants themselves or their parents are immigrants. 20% of American children grow up in a home in which English is not the dominant language. In other words, we have certain stereotypes or caricatures of what childhood is, but there is enormous diversity across race, class, gender, and the like.
Mm. A fourth myth, this one's hard. The United States is a particularly child-friendly place.
Well, we certainly believe that, and there's no question that we as parents are obsessed by our own children. And yet, whether being obsessive about children is actually good for children is a tougher question to answer. There's easy ways to look at this issue. I mean, this is a country that has the highest proportion of children growing up in poverty. About one-sixth of American children are in poverty at any one time. And it's the advanced society with the most children without health care. But the problems of children aren't just confined to the poorest of our children. We have hovering parents who are making it more difficult for children to develop an independent identity. We have schools that are less pleasurable in the past. They're somewhat more regimented and more test-minded than they were when you and I were growing up. It's not clear to me that that childhood is as joyful as it once was.
A final myth, which is perhaps, you say, the most difficult to overcome, is a myth of progress.
Well, there's no question that particularly for girls and particularly for children of color, childhood is better in very measurable ways. And yet, we have to be careful about what we say. For example, clearly child death rates have plummeted, and that is a great advance. But we sometimes forget that in the course of that, the number of children with disabilities has also increased. Today, about 6% of American children have very serious physical or mental disabilities. And it's easy to deny the existence of this, but the fact is that it appears that there are more children today suffering from chronic illnesses or disabilities than at any other time in the past, and that we simply don't have the caregiving system to take adequate care of them.
Is it fair to say, then, that childhood is a condition, obviously it's a biological condition, but culturally it's a condition that adapts to every era in which it finds itself, and, well, I guess the one constant you have is that everybody's convinced the next generation is going to pot.
Exactly. I argue that childhood is a construct. And it's a construct created by many, many different groups of people, by theologians and educators and psychologists, but it's also created by children themselves. In our own time, we see childhood changing very dramatically right before our eyes, and kids are playing a crucial part in that. When they instant message, when they use cell phones, that's a sign of change, a childhood that's very different than yours or mine. Right now, there's a real obsession about the quote-unquote commercialization of childhood, and there is no question that marketers are playing on children with all the wiles once reserved for adults. But one reason they're doing that is because it's much more difficult than in the past to reach child consumers, because children are tuning in to other methods of communication, and advertisers are struggling desperately to reach them.
Our guest is Stephen Mintz. He's the author of Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with a call from Stormy. Stormy's calling from West Bloomfield in Michigan.
Hi. I actually came upon a very, very interesting find in an old safe from an auction, and it was almost a daily diary of two twins that were born in 1927. And the father was the main caretaker. The mom was inattentive, and actually in the whole diary ended up passing away early in the children's childhood. But I was just amazed at the different medical treatments they were given. Coal oil, which is kerosene and sugar, belladonna, enemas almost weekly. How did kids survive?
How did they survive, Stephen Mintz?
Well, children are more resilient than we believe. We embrace that romantic notion of children as fragile and vulnerable creatures. But in fact, children have put up with incredible challenges to their existence. Slavery, over half of all slaves were under the age of 16. We can think of the harshest existence possible, and children somehow survive that. Diaries are incredible sources for looking into the past. Much of the history of childhood turns out to be actually the history of adults, that is, of parenting. But what we want to do is to try to recover children's voices and children's opinions. We don't want them simply to be seen, but we want them to be heard.
That's wonderful.
Stormy, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
And I know that people are going to be calling in with a lot of questions about what's going on today. But before we leave history entirely, I did want to point out that the Puritans, who sometimes get a rap as being rather cold, emotionless, and humorless, you say were in fact obsessed with children, and that's why they came here in the first place.
Right. They were convinced that their children were growing corrupt, first in England, then they moved to Holland, and they were felt that they were being corrupted there. And so the Pilgrims came first, and later they were followed by larger numbers of Puritans. And the obsession began even with newborns. There was a conviction, for example, that crawling was animal-like, and so they didn't allow their children to crawl. They put them in walkers almost immediately. They believed that having an upright posture was a sign of moral uprightness, and so they put literally a rod down children's spines in order to ensure that they had proper posture. In other words, there was an obsession with childhood, which I would argue in secularized form has lasted to today.
If you have questions about the history of American childhood, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Stephen Mintz. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston, also the author of the newly published book, Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. We're back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the history of childhood in America, the changing roles children have played, and the changing views society has held of them. You're invited to join our discussion. How can we learn from how children were treated in the past? Are there lessons to adopt or avoid? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. With us is Stephen Mintz, the author of Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. And you only need to recall your reading assignments from grade school to realize how much the roles for and ideas about children have changed. Remember the feral, almost demonic Pearl of the Scarlet Letter, the heroic apprentice, Johnny Tremaine of the American Revolution, the hardy pioneer children who followed their parents in the wagon trains, or, well, we mentioned him already, boisterous, free-spirited Huck Finn. In modern terms, most of them were victims of neglect, if not outright child abuse. Stephen Mintz, we see them very differently as we look through those sediment-colored glasses.
Right. I mean, there is an attempt to idolize the past and to contrast it with a present that has fallen away. But I think it is absolutely crucial for us to take a more balanced point of view and to understand that of all the revolutions in American life, the most dramatic, most far-reaching occurred over the past century, and that is a revolution in children's lives. We transform children from workers into students, into consumers, and into, now again, teenage service workers. And what I find of concern is that many young people do not find those roles very fulfilling. They're more isolated from the adult world than ever before, and they experience a kind of rolelessness. That is, there isn't a sense that what they're doing is meaningful to them.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number again is 800-989-8255. Steve is with us from Anchorage in Alaska.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I was that my grandfather's life experience was almost exactly like the one that your guest has been describing. I mean, he was born on a tennis farm. His father was absent quite a bit, an alcoholic. It was the family was pretty much headed by his mother, and that he had like a fourth grade education, and at a very early age worked in the fields, you know, clearing rocks and picking cotton. And then shortly after he finished the fourth grade, at some point when he was in his teens, he ended up working as a busboy in like oil field cafeterias, you know. So that was his life experience, was I guess was very typical of the time. But, you know, what I was thinking is that, you know, there's kind of this secularist, you know, religion divide in this country. But the one value that I think that we all share and what Jesus taught was, you know, the way that you're supposed to, like, love the children. And I think that's a metaphor for taking care of the next generation. So, you know, that's my idea, that the secularists and the religionists could actually share this value that our goal and our priority needs to, in our society, needs to be, are we taking care of the next generation?
Most of the major reforms that have occurred in American history literally happened because of just what you're describing. That is, we described what the world was like in 1900, and a small group of reformers, they call themselves child savers, utterly transformed childhood. They launched pure milk campaigns that brought down child mortality. They persuaded the states to open a new high school every day for 30 years in order to make high school education universal in this country. They abolished child labor. They established pensions that would eventually be called welfare, that would allow single mothers to keep their children at home instead of putting them in orphanages, which had been the practice in the past. I mean, many of you probably know that Babe Ruth, the baseball star, grew up in an orphanage, but it wasn't because he didn't have two parents. He did. They simply could not afford to keep him at home.
Steve, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Let's talk now with Scott, and Scott is with us from Minneapolis.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
All right.
This is a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
This is kind of a tangent, but, I mean, considering history often, you know, teaches us what the future may hold. Your guest had mentioned a little bit ago one of the myths of that there were, like, 20 to 30% of single-parent homes, and I don't know what the causes were in history, but, you know, as a divorced parent with an 8-year-old, you know, and understanding that somewhere around 50% of marriages are failing, I guess my question is, you know, when my daughter's 30 and half of her peers grew up in, you know, single parent homes or, you know, with step parents and that type of thing, you know, are they resilient? Does that matter? You know, what kind of effect might that have? And I'll get off the phone here so I can hear your response.
Okay, Scott, thanks.
Families aren't some kind of sitcom ideal. Families are relationships. And I think everything matters about whether you and your daughter have a good and close, emotionally connected relationship. If you do, I think things will be fine. If you don't, then it's going to be much tougher. Most of the scholarship that has been done on the impact of divorce shows that for some children, but a small minority, it has lasting effects. But for the overwhelming majority, they grow up just like children from intact families. Again, the point I would want to stress is that children are amazingly resilient. The problems that children face today are nothing compared to the problems the kids faced in the past. They survive those, and they'll survive now. Let me just give you an example of that. Let's take someone growing up at the time of William Shakespeare. They would have been wrapped as an infant in swaddling clothes. These are bands. And then they might have even been hanged on a nail by the doorway. By our standards, they would have lacked emotional stimulation. They would have lacked physical stimulation, and this would have catastrophic effects. Yet this is the world that would give rise to William Shakespeare. Young children were often moved from their parental home to the home of a wet nurse who would nurse them, then back again, then they would go work in other people's homes. We believe stability in childhood is absolutely essential. And yet, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of children grew up very differently, and they turned out okay.
Let's talk with Ann. Ann is calling from Sandy in Utah.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking this call. This is just something I've been thinking about. I'm a teacher, and I'm also doing an awful lot of observing in different early childhood programs. And young children today are faced with this Leave No Child Behind Act. And with that, what we're looking at are high test scores and academic achievement being the number one most important aspect of school. And here's what I'd like your guest to speak on. My hope is that one day we will return wholeheartedly to what we call in education the whole child or a developmental approach. And for many of us, I don't think we're dinosaurs. A lot of us still believe that the best way for young children to learn is through play. Could you ask your speaker to please comment on that one?
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Ann.
It is always shocking to read, for example, letters written during the Civil War by children and discover how eloquent they were, or to read, of course, Lincoln's speeches and discover that he didn't have a formal education. Clearly, there are a variety of ways to learn, and a test-driven approach is not the only effective approach. I am very concerned that we have moved away from what I would call age-appropriate learning. There is a day that young children can do certain kinds of mathematics, and you can push them all you wish before then, and they still can't do it. But when the moment comes when learning is truly age-appropriate, they can learn. I couldn't agree more with the caller about the necessity of learning in every imaginable way. Play is an important part of that. Children need to be active learners. If there is anything that we have learned in recent years, it's that children construct knowledge through their engagement of the world. And it's that process of constructing knowledge that is learning, not simply instilling knowledge or pressing knowledge into their brain.
And does that connect with your earlier point about children not doing work that seems to be have a point to them? In other words, they're not employing these lessons that they're learning. They're flipping burgers.
I would absolutely agree with that. That what do affluent parents do when they can to help their children? They get their children various kinds of internships. In other words, they try to recreate that earlier apprenticeship system that actually worked pretty well. It had its abuses, and I write about those abuses.
Indeed, yes.
But it certainly had its positive aspects. I'm hoping that we are beginning to inch back towards that kind of model. But we have to extend it beyond the affluent parents who have lots of connections to a much wider range of young people who would also benefit from the chance of interacting with people who aren't their same age.
Let's talk to Zeke. Zeke is calling from Dayton, Ohio.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm listening, I wonder, are we coming like a full circle back to like the Puritan days where the children are being much more subversive about meeting the need to explore and meet the need for adventure? I myself work in a residential program for youth that have, basically been put there either through courts or parental decision. And the stories I hear from them just keep rolling back to where parents are overbearing, not letting them explore. And when they do explore, it would be, it's a bad thing for them. They're heading down the bad path.
Overprotective, Stephen Mintz?
I don't.
Hovering parenting is one of the characteristics of our time. Parents today agonize over their children, I think, more than any generation in the past. And in some ways, of course, that's good, and in some ways it's justifiable. We look at the past and we see that children died from easily preventable causes. For example, Puritan children often fell into wells or into fireplaces.
And there were bears in the woods in those days.
Absolutely. And yet, there's something slightly hysterical about our sense of risk to our children today. Speaking as a parent myself, I don't believe that my children played outside of my sight or some other adult's sight until they were 10 years old. How can you break the umbilical cord if you have parents hovering over you? You watch how children trick-or-treat on Halloween, and you'll see their parents close by. I mean, this is an exaggerated set of fears that really, I think, does harm our children.
You go back to an institution, I think, created by the second generation of immigrants into Puritan New England, where they created a system of tithing men to keep an eye on their children?
Yes. Benjamin Franklin's father was a tithing man. These were individuals who were assigned to 10 or 12 homes, and their idea was to keep a close watch because it was taken for granted that parents could not adequately discipline their own children, and so the tithing men would report to central authorities.
Even then. We're talking with Stephen Mintz about his new book, Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Steve, who's calling from Berkeley, California.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I read some years back that the average age of a woman for first childbirth in colonial America was 16, and that the average age for first marriage was 18. And it's interesting you mentioned Benjamin Franklin, because his child was born, his only child was born to a woman, girl, and she was about age 16 at the time.
Hmm.
I wonder how true that is.
Actually, people married and bore children surprisingly late. In other words, they married and had children about the same time that we do today. Now, the reason was different. The reason was that in general, you inherited land after your father died, and you couldn't start a family until you inherited land. And so that meant that men married in their mid or late 20s, and women married in their early or mid-20s. This was absolutely crucial in helping to restrict the birth rate, even though the birth rate was quite high in colonial America. The average woman had between 7 and 10 children, which is pretty close to the biological maximum.
Hmm.
And so the teenage pregnancy was not a problem then?
They had a remarkably low rate of both illegitimacy and what we call, premarital pregnancies of any kind, which would then be solved by a shotgun wedding. The rates were extremely low, though they rose right before the American Revolution until about one-third of brides were pregnant on their wedding day. Clearly, fathers were losing control over their children even then.
Thank you.
Steve, thanks for the phone call. One of the fascinating, and these are more than tidbits because you weave them together into a story, but one of the fascinating tidbits you run across in your book is that the word teenager did not appear in print until 1941.
The development of new life stages is one of the most striking aspects of our history. We are obsessed with life stages. We've just created a new one, the tweens. We used to have preteens, we used to have teeny boppers, but now the tween seems to be both a marketing category and a category used by psychologists as well. We also seem to be getting a new age stage just beyond the childhood years. That is a stage that doesn't have a name yet but refers to early adulthood, a kind of extended adolescence that extends through the 20s into the early 30s. But the most important, the most influential, the one that has dominated our culture for decades now was the rise of the teenager. First, there was the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland clean teen, and then kids rebelled against that image. And we got the rebels without a cause, the Natalie Woods, the James Deans, and the Elvis Presleys.
And then, of course, this has continued to evolve to this day. One thing about the constant, though, this fear of the next generation, that still exists around now. I mean, if we could have tithing men today, I suspect we'd hire them.
There is, I said earlier that parents today are unusually controlling. And one side effect of that is a great fear of loss of control. By most measures, kids are doing better than in the past. That is, rates of smoking have gone down. Rates of teen pregnancy have gone down. Drug use is lower today than it was among these children's parents. And yet there is a kind of moral panic in our society that somehow teens are out of control, that they're becoming aliens. We could see this in movies like 13 or Kids or Elephant, this sense that kids are out of control. This is grossly exaggerated. It is not substantiated by the statistics, and yet it reflects this deep fear on the part of parents of a loss of control.
Stephen Mintz, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Stephen Mintz is the author of Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood. He is also a professor of history at the University of Houston and joined us today from the studios of member station KUHF in Houston, Texas. When we come back from a short break, an update on Ukraine. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.